Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino. On this episode, we talk with best-selling author, guitarist, composer, educator, and entrepreneur Nick Morrison. He is a very busy musician and entrepreneur with a deep skill set and is very well-versed in guitar, music theory, online promotion, educational platforms, and streaming. Over the COVID years, he has been busy writing and publishing instructional books and getting involved with new technologies as we move forward beyond 2022. He has great stories and insights into the world of music and even living in Japan for 5 years. There's a lot in here. Enjoy this interview.
Nick, thanks for taking a minute out. You are a busy man. With that in mind, I am curious, how did you survive the pandemic over the last couple of years with things being altered so much?
Wow. Good question. I mean, honestly, I've been doing okay. Like everybody else, I mean, it's been a shift of perspectives, a shift of lifestyle, a shift in routines. Luckily, you know, my business, you know, is not entirely predicated on live performance. So obviously that, you know, I've not been able to get out and gig over the past 2+ years. You know, thankfully writing music for film and television allows me to have, you know, work remotely and not really have to go into a studio or see other musicians. I can produce right from my home studio. And then, of course, over the past couple of years, I've gotten into writing instructional books for guitarists, starting a whole online learning platform, if you will, which is this guitardojo.ca, in case anybody's interested in checking it out. But that's really allowed me not really have to worry as much about getting out to gig. And, you know, at this point, I mean, I hate to say it, but if gigging never comes back, I'm okay without it.
You know, and the interesting thing is I do so many interviews with musicians, and I think that there is an aspect of that live environment that's just totally irreplaceable. But at the same time, I do find that a lot of people have really been able to sustain themselves because there is online learning and there are other opportunities and avenues that have totally kept that boat afloat.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even if you're one that is so inclined, like I much prefer playing with live musicians, but there are several of my friends have gone into the, you know, live streamed via YouTube or live streamed via Facebook with the tip jar model, right? With like buymeacoffee.com or what is the PayPal me or whatever, where, you know, they just do sort of living room concerts, as it were, and have their followers, you know, tip them or provide some income that way. I don't know of anybody that's really making a full-time income doing that, but it's certainly something that they've been able to do to supplement.
Yeah, I think it subsidizes things. And I think the thing from my perspective looking in on this as an admirer of music is I think it's going to make the music community stronger. I think there's ways that people are going to continue to support this. And I guess this is a lead into my next question.
Sure.
You know, I think the appreciation for the audiences is going to be pretty epic once we all kind of get back into full force. There will be a new level. Yeah. So, I mean, do you feel like that's the case? Have you seen that yourself yet?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the one thing that I think, you know, in terms of musicians and artists, I think this time, especially if you've been able to, it's funny to even, I suppose, as a musician, most of us, I think, don't really think of it as a job, although it is, right? It's a career. But one of the things that I think has really made this job special or really reinforced how lucky we are to be musicians and be creators and be, you know, whatever, even if it's online educators or whatever it happens to, I shouldn't say even if, you know, if it's online education or whatever it happens to be, it's really taught me the value of my audience, and the relationship building aspect of business is I don't care what business you're in, it's a people business. So being able to connect with people one-to-one, even virtually, is so important. And I've built better relationships over this past couple of years with my audience in terms of getting to know them personally on a one-to-one level. And I don't mean, you know, of all the hundreds of thousands of students that have purchased my books or all of the people that watch my YouTube stuff or whatever, but, you know, the ones that have really taken time to be a part of my community and continue to support me, it's so invaluable, and they know it. And I always strive to go so far above and beyond to provide them more value, whether it's, you know, just time with me or connection or extra education or, you know, hey, even just having a phone call to check in and say, hey, how you doing? You know, it's phenomenal, and I think that's something that this time has taught not just me, but again, all of the musician friends that I have all said very, very similar things.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's the thing. It's all about the silver linings. You know, for all of the panic and dread and unknown that we went into with this, I think it's really just kind of emblematic of our times. Is that, you know, I don't know that any of us, I mean, I know I'm almost 50. I'll be 50 this year. It's like,
yeah,
I've seen things happen. We've seen 9/11, the Challenger explosion.
Yeah.
There's been things that we've seen, but on a global, everybody on the same playing level, you know, hell yeah, this is it. It's on. Like, this was the time for all of us to be like, all right, we're going to have to just figure this out. They got a monopoly on us.
What is that old say? I think people say it's Chinese. I don't know if I necessarily believe that, but it's kind of like a blessing and a curse of the may you live through interesting times.
Right. Well, you know, and as a musician too, I remember watching that Bob Dylan biopic, and at one point he was having a dream, and he was in this house, and he was just sweating over what he was going to write, and there was an old housemaid that came in and said, just write what you see. And I think about right now for artists, this is an epic time. I mean, not only did America have a pandemic, we added like a race war and class war, all of these things.
Yep.
We add so much gasoline to already an existing inferno. So for artists, if you can't find a way to write or create something, you probably
yep.
need to pick accounting or something else to get into.
Oh, for sure. I mean, depending on the type of art that you make, but, you know, even if you're not like, Dylan is a great example, right? Because he was a social commentator. One might even argue probably the best, one of the best of all time. But, you know, even if you're not in that space where you're writing music or creating art that is social commentary, whether it be political, social, class, race, whatever, okay, so maybe you're creating escapism as an antithesis to everything that's going on. As you say, yeah, if you can't find inspiration right now, maybe you need to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
there's so much, you know.
Well, speaking of inspiration, let's go to your roots. Talk to me a little bit about where you were born and raised and how this dream of music became real for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was born in the 70s in Windsor, Ontario, which is right across the border from Detroit. And at that time, Windsor, I mean, of course, Detroit's always had the legacy of Motown and great music. But Windsor also, because it shared that border and because it's so close, was always a great music town. And I remember going across the border to various clubs with my grandfather or my uncles and going to see great players. Like I saw, you know, probably half of the Funk Brothers play in, you know, jazz and blues clubs in Detroit before I even knew who they were, you know. And so that really informed my childhood and sort of my early reminiscences of music. And my grandfather used to play drums sort of in the late 50s and early 60s in cover bands and a wedding bands, that sort of thing. My uncle is a professional jazz musician. He lives in Toronto. So music was always a part of my life. My grandmother was an aspiring or budding concert pianist when she got married and got pregnant. And so, you know, I've always been surrounded by music, and it just has always been a part of my life. And I always knew, it's weird, I think, maybe not necessarily as like a, okay, I know I can do this for a living, or I know I can make this a job, but I always knew that music would be a part of my life. And, you know, I started violin lessons, I think it was about 2.5, because I thought I wanted to be like a classical musician. So my mom got me set up with the Suzuki Method. There was a great instructor in Windsor. And I played from 2 until about 9 when I gave it up, and I wish I hadn't, although had I not given it up, I wouldn't have come to the place where I am now, you know? So everything kind of happened
yeah.
for a reason. But I hated practicing, and that was the biggest problem for me, because I just wouldn't practice. I played piano for a little while, you know, I think as most kids do. My mom got me involved in piano lessons so that I could have a better understanding of, you know, music and theory, I guess, as it were, and sort of ended up giving that up. And then I found guitar around age 12. And I fell in love, and it was one of those times where every waking moment, whether I was at school or at, you know, work or hanging out with my cousins or my, you know, my grandparents or whatever, if I was thinking about guitar, if I didn't have guitar in my hand, I was thinking about guitar. Like, it was all consuming. And at that time, you know, there wasn't the internet. So like the ubiquity of information in terms of like learning to play the instrument and like learning songs, like basically, I'm sure you remember there's like Guitar Player magazine, and there were a few of them, there were a handful of them, and you would get one or two or three transcriptions per month, and that was about it. So like I came up with really weird and interesting ways. Like I remember talking to, you know, players slightly older than myself that would like weight down the needle on their records to sort of slow it down. You know, they'd put it from 78 down to 33 or down to like 28.5 to slow the record, and then they'd weight the needle to slow it down even more. I kind of did the same thing, but I actually would stretch my tapes out, and I would like put them in and then re-spool them and put them in the player, and then you'd get this weird warbly but slowed down version of songs. And I sat in hours trying to figure out how to like retune my guitar so that I could play along with my tapes to learn my favorite solos and my favorite songs and stuff. So, I mean, you know, I came up really, it sounds funny, I'm like, in my day, I used to walk uphill both ways to school, you know?
Yeah.
But I did, I came up the hard way. And I was self-taught from, you know, 12 to 21 or 22 when I decided to go to Berkeley. And that was really when I, you know, really buckled down and learned to read and learn jazz and read, you know, learn theory and chord analysis and all the cool stuff that comes with that, plus the exposure to all of the world-class phenomenal players that are both instructors and students at that school. And it was such a great opportunity to be there.
You know, I got to say, I went to Detroit back in the 90s. I remember Creep came out from Radiohead. I remember listening to that on the radio. But anyways, I remember going over the border and I snuck Cubans in, and I was so scared. I was like, oh my God, dude, how am I going to do this? But I remember getting back. I was in my 20s, my roaring 20s. My buddies and I lit that thing up. In fact, I found one the other day, and a good friend of mine just, he had a birthday. And I found it because I just moved in January of 2020. I was like, dude, here you go, my last Cuban. Speaking of travel, you spent 5 years in Japan. That had to be phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. It's like one of the things I tell people is like everything that you've heard about Japan is true and more, and also none of it. It's such a weird place. It's like being on Mars. But I loved every moment of it. I still have some phenomenal friends that live there, both Japanese and expat alike. You know, for the first probably 2.5, maybe 3 years that my wife and I were back in Canada, we constantly would refer to home, quote unquote, as Osaka in Japan, because that's where we lived. And it really took us quite a while to really fully reintegrate into Canadian society after having that experience. But yeah, it was great.
You know, I will tell you one thing that I am increasingly, the more I interview jazz musicians in Canada, I love the Canadians more and more. You have free health care. They give grants to musicians all the time. And Trudeau the other day just put a very large ban on guns that we won't ever do in America. So the thing I like about the Canadians is the government puts its money where its mouth is. And for the mental health of the people to feel like they won't go bankrupt for medical care and that they can create art that's going to sustain the vitality of their people, and then they're going to keep guns out of criminal hands or anybody else. It's like there's an evolved thought. Like here in America, everybody thinks, well, if you pass one piece of legislation, it's all going to go down. No, it's not. It's going to restrict people that don't need to be doing certain things in our society. But the Canadians get it.
Yeah, I think for the most part, we do a pretty good job. We're not without our faults. We're not without our own social challenges. You know, obviously the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, was quite prevalent here as well. And over the past couple of years, we've had a lot more recognition and upset and turmoil with our First Nations Indigenous nation within Canada. So there's been a lot of upheaval and a lot of upset there as well. So we're not without our own social issues, but when it comes to important stuff, as you say, like you know, healthcare and protection and or you know, outlawing of guns and things like that. And of course, support of musicians and culture, I think, for the most part, the Canadian government does really, really well with it. I mean, you know, we've got the CRTC here, which is the Canadian Radio and Television Commission, and they sort of govern a lot of that legislation, you know, the reason that we have the CBC still is because of them. And we really do push Canadian content. So we have these CanCon laws. So, you know, obviously being so close to the U.S., you know, as you turn on the radio, you're going to hear a lot of mainstream American radio, whether it's pop or rock or jazz or whatever. But, you know, it's mandated at least 30%. It can be more, but a minimum of 30% must be Canadian, from Canadian artists, which I think is really cool. And to your point about, you know, grants and things as well, there are everything in the, you know, the gambit of a few hundred dollars all the way up to several hundreds of thousands of dollars for artists sort of at all levels to, you know, buy new equipment or further their education or reach out and work with a mentor or whatever it happens to be. So it's a really, you know, it is a really great place to be for sure.
So who would you consider a hero for you? Who do you look up to?
You know, I haven't really thought about it in a long time. I mean, in terms of, it's going to sound funny because anybody that knows me knows, like, I'm very much in the sort of progressive rock and progressive metal world. That's really, like, my milieu. But I've made the bulk of my professional living playing country music. So that's, you know, a whole other story. But when it comes to players, I think my favorite player probably is John Petrucci. But I think in terms of, like, somebody that I would look up to the most, and this is probably, like I said, it's going to kind of sound weird to a lot of people, unless they know me, but, like, I really look up to Brian Setzer, you know, because the guy, you got to look at, like, the late 70s, right? You've got the new wave movement, you've got punk, you've got, you know, synth pop and that kind of thing being to the forefront. And here's a guy at, what, 17 or 18 years old says, no, you know what, I'm going to play 50s rock and roll.
Yeah,
I'm going to get a big hollow body Gretsch and I'm going to play music like it was 1959. And he's never wavered from that. Of course, he's, you know, done the Brian Setzer Orchestra and whatever else, but the guy's always done it his way, with his vision and with what he thought was cool. And the reason that I bring that up, I think it's so important, especially now with the age of the internet and the ubiquity of, there's so much art, like there's so much music out there, and there's, like, how do you find it? And the biggest thing that a lot of sort of my students and peers are always asking me, they're like, Nick, like, how do I find my audience? How do I do, you know, how do I reach people? And the biggest thing I say again and again is just, like, be you. People will find you. It may take a while, but do it your way. Do it what you want. Like, there's only one you. Nobody can be you better than you. And so, like I said, for me, I think Setzer really embodies that more than almost any other artist I can think of.
Yeah, that's a great point, man. That's totally true. You know, you put out a lot of stuff. You've interacted a lot with fans. What's been one of the best pieces of either fan mail or fan response you've gotten?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Wow, off the top of my head, probably just lately over the past couple of years with the introduction of my guitar course that I've got. It's called the Fretboard Infinity Loop System. Basically, I teach people how to improvise. One of the students sent me an email. I was just like, man, I've been playing for 20 plus years or whatever it's been. He's like, nobody's ever been able to explain to me, like, how to do guitar. Nobody's been able to explain it to me in such a simple way that actually makes sense. So thank you. And to me, I'm just like, that's worth more than just about anything else. You know, like, to say that I'm not in this business to make money is ridiculous. But if I just took that one comment and I'm just like, wow, I made it click for somebody, everything that I do is worth it, because, like, I've now changed that person's life musically, not necessarily, you know, for everything, but, like, musically, I made music make sense, and he's able to connect with his instrument, and he's now able to express himself better than he could before. And that's kind of my whole goal, right? I want to make music fun again for people. I don't want them to be mired down going, well, should I learn this or should I learn that, or, oh, theory is so hard, blah, blah, blah. Like, let's throw that all out the window. Let's figure out how to get you playing and having fun.
For sure. So let's say you have a dream tonight. You run into the younger version of yourself, say around in your 20s or when you're starting to play professionally, and you could give your younger person one piece of advice based on what you've learned, the wisdom you've gained over the years. What would you tell your younger version?
Well, probably nothing, because I wouldn't have listened to myself anyway. like, let's be honest.
I dig it.
20-year-old me would have probably told me to F off and then gone continue to do what I was doing anyway. But realistically, I think that piece of being true to yourself and just figuring out, you know, you're not going to be your perfect self at 19 or at 20 or at 21 or at 35 or even 42. It's a never-ending process. All you can do is be true to who you are right now. And if who you are right now says, hey, man, I want to figure out how to, you know, be the best jazzer that I am, or I'm going to be the best country guy that I am, or I'm going to be the best rock player, whatever it happens to be, just sink your teeth in and get at it and just be that. Don't try to be everything for everybody. You know, find you, find your voice, and just stick to it and have fun. Damn the torpedoes, as Tom Petty would say, and go after what it is that you love.
So everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your fans, your students, but ultimately you live your life. You're in control of your destiny. Who do you think you are?
Who do I think I am? Interesting question. Man, you've thrown me some interesting curveballs today, I got to tell you. I'm a guitar player. I'm an educator. I'm hopefully a good communicator. And ultimately what I strive to be at this point in my, at this particular point in my career is kind of highlighted with that email that I was telling you about. Like, I strive to give other players light bulb moments to allow them to either see the guitar fretboard or make sense of theory or, you know, make sense of songwriting, you know, like I do some songwriting workshops and whatnot here and there as well. And the entire goal is to help other people have those illuminating or those light bulb moments. So I think really that's kind of who I am and where I'm at right now in my journey and as an educator and as a musician. Like, even looking back over my career, my entire goal as a guitar player has always been to make other people look or sound as good as they can look. Like, where the heck was I? It doesn't matter, but I was setting up for a gig once, and I was backing up, like, a female pop singer. You know, I was tuning up and turning on my amp or whatever, and the house sound guy came up on stage, and he's like, what I'm about to say to you, I have never said to another guitar player in my entire career, and he's been doing it for 40-odd years or something. You know, like one of those old, grizzled sound guys. He's got, like, a cigarette hanging out of his mouth and another one ready to light. And he says to me, I need you to turn your guitar up. Which sounds insignificant, but should kind of give you, like, I always believe in serving the song and serving other musicians. And I feel like if you can make others look their best, sound their best, perform their best, it makes you better just by default, just by being there.
That's beautiful. And that's the thing. If you're going to do something, do it well, and supporting those around you is a pretty big deal, I think, especially in the world that we live in now. It's
totally
very essential, you know, with the community that we have. But, you know, so we can keep the lights on and everything working. Everything Nick Morrison can be found at guitardojo.ca. So, man, Nick, it's been wonderful to talk with you. Good luck with everything that you got going on. It's been great to get
to
know you.
Thanks, man. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's been a fantastic time. I look forward to doing it again if it works out in the future at some point.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another famous interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, literature, and music around the globe. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. You could see these on the Neon Jazz YouTube channel. And for everything Joe Domino related, go to joedomino.com. And when you're there, you can kick into the cause via PayPal or Patreon. Until next time.